Blog Talk Radio.
Graham Hancock. You're listening to Earth Ancients with Cliff Dunning.
And how you doing today? Hope you're doing well. You know, there's so much happening archaeologically around the world. Of course, we're focused on ancient archaeology. Most of the time, it's about prehistoric events, events that aren't necessarily chronicled. And I always drive people to the Facebook page, and there's so much going on each week. You just can't keep up with it. And this is why I'm working to build a website that has regular updates, that has links to a lot of the other websites out there that are posting information from researchers. And then there's special websites that have daily information on discoveries, on research that is being unveiled on the university level, and also there's a great deal of independent research that's out there that isn't reported in the mainstream that I like to follow. And a lot of the people that are on the show are independent researchers. We occasionally have an academic, but it's all about, you know, the point of view of the individual. And I do my best not to judge. Occasionally you'll hear me say something like, oh, really? When it comes to a statement or someone's opinion. But we're pretty open here. We try to be pretty open. I'm not an intellectual. I am somewhat educated. I have a college education. But I'm a writer. I'm hoping to continue to publish, and we'll announce the books that I do publish. But I try to keep an open mind, and I think you who have been listening to the show now for over a year have a sense of where we're going and what we do here. But that being said, the network has asked me to broaden the show and has offered me a chance to create my own network. And I'm excited to consider that. And I've spoken to quite a few of the guests I've had on the show, people like Graham Hancock, Scott Walter from the History Channel, and a number of other people. And all of them have expressed an interest in being a part of the show. Now, the only thing about this possibility is that I need to have funding to do this. I have the need for an intern to work with me, this would require a unique website that is, you know, going to cost some money. And I want to do this, and I need you to help me. And the way I'm going to do this is we're going to do a funding program, a crowdfunding program. And I've had Curtis, the artist for the show, create a really amazing T-shirt. And it's going to be available as a T-shirt, a cap, or really, really cool sweatshirts. A really nice design for Earth Ancients. Remember, it's Earth Ancients, Startling New Discoveries from Our Planet's Distant Past. That's the theme, subtitle, and so what's going to happen is That information is going to be has been designed, and I'm going to make it available in this crowdfunding program that I'm hoping to launch in February. I was hoping to launch it in end of January, but just because of the amount of work I've been dealing with, I just haven't been able to launch it. But you can support this program. You can support this crowdfunding program for the Earth Ancient Network, which will have just amazing people on it that have their own program. And we're looking for, to start with, at least 2 to 3, maybe even 4 different programs that will be on Blog Talk Radio Network under the Earth Ancients banner. So as this begins to form, and I have a website that's going to be launched for this, I will announce it, and you can support it. And your supporting funds, whatever you can donate, if you can only buy a T-shirt, great. If you can buy a sweatshirt for a few bucks more, great. You know, we'll be offering packages where we offer a series of books, some other things that are for consideration for a few bucks more than maybe. Typically, a T-shirt would be $30, and a sweatshirt might be $40 or $50. We don't know. We're still working on that. But there may be some items that are above that. So the bottom line is to collect enough money to launch this website and this network. So be looking forward to that. Be listening in the future. And check back on our Facebook page, because that's one of the areas we'll launch. And then I'll announce it on this program as soon as we can get the thing up. Speaking of Facebook, there are a number of items I want you to check out. First of all, check out the amazing photo gallery by Ernest Pfeiffer. And it is an amazing view of Chichen Itza, the Mayan city in the Yucatan. And he actually posted photos probably, I'm going to guess, they were from 1970s. And the cool thing about it, this is, not only is Ernest a great photographer and these images are fantastic, Chichen Itza used to be really an adult playground. And when I say playground, you were able to go inside the buildings in the 70s and 80s. And when I was there in 1995, you were still able to climb the pyramid, the Chichen Itza pyramid. It still is called El Castillo, Spanish for the castle. And when you climbed it, you could go into the temple at the top of the pyramid, walk around, and really see an amazing view of the landscape. Well, since then, about 5 years after that, in 2000, they shut down access to climbing this pyramid or going into any of the other buildings. So this photo gallery of Chichen Itza is just spectacular, because he takes pictures inside the buildings, and it's an amateur point of view. He's not a professional photographer, and he's not working for any publication, which makes it even funner, because you can see details on the outer walls of these buildings, and it's just really, really a beautiful gallery. And you can find it on Facebook. Go to Facebook Earth Ancients and look for the group page. It's group page. So check that out. The other thing is Klaus Dana, the anomalous researcher who we've had on the show, just celebrated a birthday. And to honor him, I posted one of his great videos called Unsolved Mysteries of the Ancient Giants of the World. And in this video, which is about an hour, you can see his presentation with some of his fascinating video images, slide presentation in this video. And he's got everything from huge footprints to giant stone axes, even some skeletal remains of giants that you don't see anywhere, and they're not published in any book. You only can see him if you catch Klaus in one of his presentations. And unfortunately, he's not in America that often. He's in mostly in Europe and in South America and in Asia. He travels all over the place. We just had him, and he was in an Asian city I can't mention because I'm not supposed to talk about it. But I mean, he's all over the world looking for these artifacts. And this is a really nice way to not only honor him, but to see some of his work in a video. So check that out. It's on Earth Ancients' Facebook page. The other thing I'm going to mention is there was a German teenager, he's an 18-year-old, who put a camera on his head and climbed the Great Pyramid. Now, he not only did he climb it quickly, he got up from the base of the pyramid up to the top in probably, I want to say, 20 minutes. He scaled the Great Pyramid. And this video that he shot, it went viral. And it upset the Egyptian authorities. And I think they're sort of trying to find this guy. But this video is fascinating because he has to go. It looks like a GoPro video camera on his head. You can see him quickly looking around. How he got so close is really pretty amazing, because they have guards that walk around the perimeter of the Great Pyramid. So he must have left the tourist path, and you see him starting to climb the pyramid. But as he's climbing, he's looking around, and it's one of the most amazing views you can imagine of the whole perimeter of the Giza pyramid. But what's even more amazing is how quickly he gets up on the pyramid. He's about halfway up the top, and you can see him really breathing hard, because you know those are big 2-ton boulders that he is climbing. The fascinating thing, though, is you can see the erosion in these stones. You can see the sediment. You can see the damage that's been done over thousands and thousands of years. And God, we've been talking about the pyramid, but here's like a fresh view from a teenager's point of view, climbing this pyramid, scaling it quickly. And he's very, very efficient in how quickly he gets up there. And he's definitely spotted it out. And then he gets to the very top. And boy, the view that you see of the surrounding plateau is quite amazing. So check it out. German teenager scales a Great Pyramid. You can see it. I have it on the international Facebook page, Earth Ancients. And you can also see it on the group page. That's kind of the cool thing for the week is is this unorthodox quick scaling of the Great Pyramid. Check it out. It's fun. I want to mention one thing. For those of you who live in the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area, April 30th through May 1st is the New Living Expo. It's going to be held at the San Mateo Conference Center. And it's a great way to see some of the and hear from some of the authors on this show. They're going to have Scott Walter there. Mike Barrow is going to be giving a special presentation. Nassim Haram will be there giving a special talk. We haven't had Nassim on the show. But the reason I'm promoting this is I work with this group. And Ken Kaufman, who has produced this event for over a decade, also produced Whole Life Expo, which I was the program director for about seven or eight years back in the late 1990s. And the great thing about this show is it's very inexpensive to go to. It's $15 for the day, and you can see most of these lectures for free. And there's a huge exhibit hall to check out too. And then these top people like Scott Walter, and Clifford Mahoti will be there. The Hopi elder will be there speaking. They also give these special event presentations, and they're a little more money. They're like $40, but that's 2 hours of really unusual slides and details about discoveries and highlights from their books. So I strongly urge those of you who live in the Bay Area, and even if you're not in the Bay Area, you might consider flying in from L.A. or Reno or something. It's Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, April 29th, 30th, May 1st. You can learn more about it by going to newlivingexpo.com and checking out all the presentations there. It's really, really worth your while. I'll be there. If you're going to be hanging out, you know, send me an email. We can connect. I'll probably be introducing quite a few of the presentations. In fact, I've been even asked to present the panel discussion on, would you believe, UFOs and alien contact. So that's kind of a huge departure from the Earth Ancient sites and what I usually promote. So check it out, newlivingexpo.com. One thing I want to mention about the show, you're probably going to start hearing some advertising at the beginning, at the end. They've asked me to, you know, it's totally optional to start inserting ads, and 30-second ads will be presented in the beginning and at the end. And, I need to generate income on this program. And so I'm not going to drive that too hard. But, if you can really join us for the crowdfunding, that might eliminate some of these ads. But for now, we're going to be inserting them. Hopefully, they won't be a big annoyance, but they will be part of the program. They help support the show and help me grow the show. And we would do eventually want to have some other programs within the Earth Ancient Network. So hang in there with me on that. Okay, so here we go. Today we're talking about ancient Australia, uncovering ancient Australia. And my guest today is Stephen and Evan Strong. This was recorded from Byron Bay, Australia. And this is over an hour, and I think you're going to really enjoy this presentation. I'll come back at the end of the program, and we'll talk a little bit about our guest next week. So today we're going to venture out to the land down under, and my guests today are Stephen and Evan Strong. They, from my look at things, I've seen a lot of their work. I've actually they have a great website. It's called Forgotten Origins. And so if you want to really get an idea of what we're going to talk about today, check out ForgottenOrigins.com. And I'll be posting some photographs of some of the key things we talk about in our program today. But they are in Byron Bay, Australia. Stephen is an Australian-based researcher, author, and former high school teacher with a background in archaeology, which is interesting. He was involved in the formation of a graduate diploma of Aboriginal education, which is interesting too, and the co-author of a highly successful book called Aboriginal Australia, A Language and Cultural Kit. And Evan is his son. Evan is a researcher, historian, and author with a bachelor's degree in social science, majoring in psychology, archaeology, and anthropology. Now, it's interesting because they've co-written four books, and one of the books here has a history, which is called Forgotten Origins, which is, I guess, we'll talk a little bit about it here in a minute. But, hey, you guys, welcome to the show.
Happy to be here.
Thanks for asking us, Cliff.
Yeah, I'm glad we got a signal now. We can speak freely.
Yes. It will work much better than doing this by semaphore.
Right. Hey, let's talk about the development of your interest. Now, you both are very outspoken about ancient history in Australia.
Yeah.
And, for me in America, there's an ancient America that we're discovering. We're discovering mounds. We've had a couple of programs that are leading people to believe that the Romans actually came to North America thousands of years ago, Roman coins up and down the eastern coast. But I don't know a great deal about the ancient part of Australia other than the Aborigines. And we've had some authors on the program that have communicated and actually been in various Aboriginal settlements to get information. And there's a special language that's spoken and things like that. But other than that, in ancient Australia, we hear about certain things, but what was your kind of the focal point for you guys to kind of get going and begin developing an interest on ancient Australia?
Well, yeah, look, I'll make it very brief because I was heavily involved in education in the state of New South Wales and helped write some of the curricula up. And as I worked further and further with the original children, mm-hmm. And won their trust, then I won the trust of the parents and the grandparents. And then what basically happened was they started to show us what they've been sitting on, what they never showed white fellas because they never really trusted. And then it became obvious that the Aboriginal Studies program I was involved in putting together was being taught throughout the whole state of New South Wales, was founded on a pack of lies. And that becomes a problem. And sort of what happened was further down the line, I was asked to come back and help do a review of the course. I made it clear to them that basically what we have to do is throw the whole thing out. They would not do that. They wanted to stay with the lies they had. Mm-hmm. I left teaching. It was that simple. If they'd agreed to that, we would have put it in the course. I wouldn't be doing this now. I'd still be teaching what should be taught.
Okay, well,
so we just found out the truth.
Okay, so this new understanding that was delivered by the Aboriginal people, was it? Does it go back further than the discovery of Australia and its the way it was populated?
Oh yeah. Look, it goes way back and rewrites the whole of world history. It talks about a time when there was one universal language that went throughout the planet. It talks about a time when there were people that were traveling around the globe before that civilization fell apart. And it talks about a time in Australia where we see technology that is not in any country today. We have seen ample evidence of technology that doesn't belong anywhere until basically 50, 60 years ago. In fact, that is what we're picking up en masse.
I mean, there's an example of something which we found that they're now just saying, well, we might be able to do that in a lab, but we're not able to do that in the field for probably another couple of decades.
Yeah, there's a compass site we've been to that was cut with laser. It's so damn obvious because the eight arms are all the same depth, the same width, the same sharpness. Mm-hmm. They go down at 180 degrees, then they run back straight and come up again. And the professor from Newcastle Uni has been taken out to this site and basically said that exactly what Evan said. He said, we can't do that. We can do it in the lab, but not out in the field. Now, we're finding stuff like this all over the place, and we're asking the academics, why is it there? And the academics don't want to talk to us, or they're very upset with us. It's one of the two, or maybe it's something I've said. I'm not sure. But whatever's come out of it, there is so much stuff coming out of this country now that calls into question our assumptions about how we used to live, too. It goes back a long way.
Okay, so can you give us some highlight? I mean, the Aboriginal people that I understand about that are out in the outback, they believe they have been around 60,000 years.
Right.
And that's a hell of a number when you look upon a single strain of humanity
that's
continuously been around for 60,000 years. That's a mind blower right there. But what you're saying is that when you were working with them and teaching the youngsters, at some point you were befriended, and I'm just going to say elders brought you in and sat you down and said, look, I know you're teaching us this, but this is what our knowledge is, and I think you need to look at it. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Basically, I am saying that, but what we would also add to that is that number of 60,000 years is a mistake. It goes back much, much further. That's one thing that every elder has made clear. So their heritage, look, it's a saying we got from the elders from the very beginning. And to begin with, it was quite scary. Mm-hmm. We were keen to say the original people were not related to the Africans and were being here a long time. But when they kept insisting that all people of the world come from them, from their genetics, that was the biggest ask, and we found now the science coming out around the world has backed this up 110%. Mm-hmm. We're saying that humanity begins in Australia and flows out from Australia to the rest of the world. And the closest link that we know of, the longest link was between Australia and America. That goes on for a long, long time.
For example, probably the latest example of that connection would be in nature, and it was some Amazonian First Nation people, and they compared their genetics to all around the world, and unexpectedly, they got a hit with Australia, Papua New Guinea, which was part of Australia.
And the Andaman Islands.
And the Andaman Islands in the country near India. Mm-hmm. And so, they were their links.
And those people, they chose the people, they were the Zoo-speaking people from the Amazonian because they're the most isolated. They felt if they could track their genetics, they get a good idea of where the original people, the indigenous people, came from.
Mm-hmm.
And they were looking all over the world. Now, what they found is the strongest link in the world is Australia. Now, we're finding that all over the place. There are studies coming in, genetic studies coming in, constant genetic studies that are telling us the original people are not related to the African people or any other people. Mm-hmm. And they have the oldest set of genetics of all. So it's a story that begins there. But remember something else too, ladies and gentlemen. You have the image of the original people being naked, nomadic hunters and gatherers, which is correct.
Mm-hmm.
But what people don't know was that was not a choice of lifestyle that was made because they had no other choice. They did have one, and there was a time before then when they were very technologically advanced and gave that up. Mm-hmm. That's the interesting part of this story. The original people were aware of the technology and gave it up because they felt it got in the way of their spiritual quest.
That reminds me of the stories of the land of Lemuria, which was in the Pacific.
Oh, yeah.
And from my knowledge, and I think, Catherwood wrote a lot about Lemuria, and there's also some Mayan elders that I've spoken to that believe that the Lemurians were of such a evolutionary level that they kind of gave up technology and were more philosophical and more connected to nature. So that's kind of interesting, that the way you describe that.
Well, some of the elders we speak to call Australia Mu.
Wow.
So, yes. Oh, no. That we know that's part of this link. This is, you're spot on. You've got the link perfect.
Mm-hmm.
This is the tradition you're talking about. These people had, I mean, we have got so much stuff. We have been to about at least 50 sites that have technology that doesn't fit. It's now just a given.
Hmm.
But you're right about that. We have elders that we have called Australia Mu. They do not call it Australia. So, yeah, the link is strong because it's there.
That's very interesting. Give me an example of technology that's very advanced when you say, I went to a site. Are you suggesting like a megalithic site that had some very unusual machining done on the stone?
Oh, yeah.
Or
whatever you want, we'll give you one. When you said that, we're both smiling like, okay, which one would you like? And I think the one we in Queensland, Trina's site, would be a good one, wouldn't it, Evan?
Yeah.
Okay, Trina's site was taken to us by this lady who found this site. And when we got there, we got to a section where there was about 40 metres long and there would have been about 80 rocks, 70 to 80 rocks had been stacked on top of one another.
Mm-hmm.
And this is granite and quartz, not sandstone, granite and quartz. And each one have been cut perfectly. We've got pictures on our website.
Okay.
There's one section there which is a shrine where they've indented half an ellipse and it goes in 10 centimetres and the rocks drop in 10 centimetres and the wall picks up its line again. Now, there are about 40 of those rocks made way between half a ton to a ton, wouldn't they?
Yeah, about that.
Medium-sized rocks. But then when we go to the next site, we go to a rock there, we find these square cube rocks that have been cut, and they've got perfectly straight sides all the way around. One of them is 5 meters by 4 meters and will weigh 10 tons, and it's been cut and placed in one spot.
Hmm.
And in that particular site, there would be about 20 or 30 rocks that have been cut and lifted. We've gone to another site near Gosford called Klaus's Tunnels.
I was about to say that, actually.
And you can see that one online.
Yeah.
And everyone who said this has come straight out of South America. And there we've got three layers of rows of walls and all have four tiers to them. And the base rock for each one is either 189 or 190 mils.
Hmm.
And those ones are joined so you cannot put a cigarette paper between them. And they hold a massive shelf of sandstone underneath. We could talk about these sites probably for the next 35, 40 minutes and keep wrapping them off.
Yeah.
They are all over this country. Okay. And it's one of the reasons we're having so much trouble with the Australian government and helicopters flying above us when we go out, because they know about these sites.
You know, it's interesting.
But we have a real problem. If you start telling a real story about original people, it sort of upsets the apple cart because it changes our concept of humanity and even where they came from.
What do you think you're having issues with the government? Is it because the information is so glaringly obvious that they are going to be forced to reevaluate, or is it just that you're just making waves and you're just a troublemaker and they want to just, you know?
Well, glaringly obvious, I can give you one example. Well, we had one report. We took one ABC reporter on site once. She then had it and did an article on it, and it was the second article for the national news going around Australia. People rang us up 7 o'clock in the morning. You're not going to believe it. It's been incredibly, very, very favourable coverage. Within 3 hours, that item was taken off every news station in Australia. And it was running all over the country on the ABC, which is the Australian government newspapers. So, look, it's a long-term thing. The reasons are twofold. The first and most important reason, we've seen a treaty signed between the original people and the Egyptians. They were in this country for over 4,000 years. There's no doubt about that. We have so much archaeology now that sort of bores us a bit. But here's the trick. The original people, when the British came here, they never signed a treaty. Your mob did. You might have broken the treaties, but you signed them. If you sign a treaty with another group, you legally acknowledge their existence. The Australian people are not even written today into our constitution, in our parliament constitution. They are not acknowledged as people. This is very important. In 1965, when they did a census in Australia, the original people were counted as flora and fauna and were counted in the kangaroo count.
Oh, they
weren't proper people. This was part of Australia. We vilified these people because we stole their land. Now, here's the trick. If we can prove that other civilizations have been to this country and had agreement and treaty, and the English have no treaty, then legally, what right do the English have at the moment to be here? And the answer is none. It breaks down one of the major foundations of how this country was stolen. Now, since the original people are still not in the Constitution, therefore they're not even mentioned legally in the High Court, legally they marginally exist on the edges. Now, this changes the whole story of what they are. But secondly, it changes it further, because we say that humanity began in this country, that civilization, democracy, sailing, even brain surgery. There is evidence that brain surgery is taking place in this country before Cook came. All of this is taking place and then sold and then given to the rest of the world. Then you start to look at our story of humanity, which goes back hundreds of thousands of years, and you change it. It wasn't out of Africa. It was out of Australia. So these things start to break down the way we see where we come from, how we look at this country. The government doesn't want that out.
That's interesting.
So it's best they deny it. Or when it does sneak into the media, which it has done occasionally, has it ever?
Yes.
It gets into mainstream media. Some naive person that's young and still thinks the media's there to tell the truth, they get it in, but on every occasion the stuff gets pulled out straight away.
Interesting. You discuss on your website quite a bit about Frederick Slater, who is a key figure in archaeology in Australia, and he's actually so powerful because he's documenting and he's very, very bright and he's able to categorize different aspects of ancient Australia that he becomes a president of the Australia Archaeological, I don't know what the other part of it is, society. He's a central figure, but he made some startling discoveries. Tell us a little bit about what you discovered about Frederick Slater and why he is an important figure in Australia's history.
Well, he did. And you are right about one thing. It's very important that readers aren't... Well, readers, this is a good
start.
Listeners. I won't call them viewers. So it's very important the listeners to understand that this guy was chosen by his peers as the president of the Australian Archaeological Society. He had been paid by governments to do work. He was considered the Australian expert on Egyptology. But he was also very lucky because he got a hold of the work of Eliza Dunlop, was it?
Eliza Hamilton Dunlop.
Hamilton Dunlop, who was actually in the 1840s befriended the original people who still knew of the first sacred language that went throughout the whole planet. This is the beginning language. Mm-hmm. And they sat down with her and gave her all of the breakdowns of that language. Now, what then happened was Slater managed to get a hold of that dictionary. And then what he went to is he went to two very important sites. The one that we've been focused on is called the Standing Stone Site. Mm-hmm. And there are two mounds there, and on one of them there are 184 stones that are placed in a very particular arrangement. Now, according to Slater, he said this was the oldest temple on the planet. And he said this standing stone arrangement, and I'm using his words, and this was so radical for the time, he said it contains all knowledge that was, that is, and will ever be. He claimed this was the beginning of humanity. It's called the mystery track of life and death. And within it is basically the reason we're here. Now, he went on to say that this language, he was compiling a dictionary, and he had a book that was going to be, we're trying to chase it up at the moment, but that's a different story. And he said the language made up of at least 28,000 words. Now, the intricacy of this is the language is made up of rock arrangements, of angles, of marks, of symbols, of 16 letters of the alphabet, which he nominated. Believe it or not, the letters are there, the beginning of everything. And he claimed this was the beginning of language and knowledge. He called it Australia's Stonehenge. But we've always argued with that, haven't we, Evan?
Yes.
Because Stonehenge is very important in marking out the solstices. This is supposed to, according to the man who was considered the expert in Australia, mark out the beginning of humanity. And he wrote once to the guy that was working with him. He said, I want you to consider yourself when Petrie and Carter, when they went into the pyramids and into the tombs, he says, your work is much more important than theirs because you are walking in on the beginning of humanity, how it began and the lessons we were given there.
Interesting.
So this is what he claims, not us,
right,
but he claims that.
Now,
so we've been to the site.
Yeah. Now, did you term the site that he found the Stonehenge of Australia, or is that a different site?
No, that's his terminology. That's what he called it.
Okay.
Because at the time, he was trying to get people around the world to acknowledge its importance. Well, you know, what would you do at that stage if you want people to get acknowledged? You use something
right
that people understand.
The reason I'm asking, but I want to ask you about that real quickly, because he was prominent in the 1930s, 1939, I believe.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
But Stonehenge was, though it was known in England, it didn't have the notoriety it had that it has today. What is it about this location and its stone arrangement that he would identify it as an Australian version of the famous Stonehenge?
Well, you've got the three large rocks.
Okay.
Now, they've been stolen. We're still chasing them up, and we have a name, so we're working on that, aren't we, Evan? We're on the list that those rocks weighed a lot. Now, the reason he said this, they weighed over a ton. The reason he said this is very simple, because alongside that is the second mound. And geologists and geographers have all looked at this and have all agreed with what I'm going to say. No one will disagree with this. All of the fill there, all of the rocks, everything, the 3,500 cubic meters of exotic fill does not belong there. None of it belongs there, and it's been picked up and carried a long distance. Now, all of the rocks that were placed on that mound. This area is in the middle of a caldera, which is volcanic, are all sandstone. They are not local. All of these rocks have been cut and shaped and placed. Can you see the analogy between the two there? And were brought a distance and placed on top of this mound. Now, as a result, he's looking at that as an archaeologist. He knew about Stonehenge, and he knew it was important because he was probably one of the most important archaeologists in the country.
Mm-hmm.
He would have been up to date with the recent arrangements. He would have known what was going to happen. But he also said in his notes this was far more important because it's the beginning of everything. What's fascinating is what we also find there is those rocks. We have rocks that were given to us by the elders because we never take them off site. I have one rock that is so sharp if you ran it across your face, you would bleed. Now, this was tough. in Australia, and we know it wasn't done by Europeans. We know because the mound was stumbled upon by Europeans in 1840 and original people on top of it. This mound was cut by original people who are only supposed to have a stick, stone and bone technology. How can you make a rock that is that sharp, it can cut you, and it was cut thousands of years ago? The technology that's on that site, the sharpness of the cuts, the lack of percussion points, tells me once again, wherever we go, there were tools taken, but that were held here when this was cut, that are very intriguing, to say the least.
Okay.
Slater knew about this.
That's interesting. Now, Stonehenge has these megaliths, and megaliths that are on the top, there's certain points that have been cut into the stone, so they allow a top cap piece to go in, and then it's a circular enclosure that surrounds whoever walks in the middle. What I mean, I've seen the pictures of this location. Where, first of all, where is it in Australia? Where is the Stonehenge, Australia Stonehenge?
We've never given up the full location because of the fact that we have to protect the site.
Oh, okay.
I am allowed to say that it's within the Byron Bay Mullumbimby area where we're living. It's in that area. It's the most easterly part of Australia.
Okay. All right.
And by the way, the Stonehenge site, that particular site we're talking about, is part of a complex of sites.
Yeah, so time's gone past all the area around it would have been submerged in water. So it actually stands out from what's going on. So in that sense,
it would have been an island.
It was a kind of a certain mount.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting. So it does have an artificial leveled base, and then the stones were placed on top of it?
Oh, God, yeah. The whole thing's artificial. There was actually 10 acres of stone arrangements around it, as well as.
Wow.
It was a massive complex. There were thousands upon thousands of rocks that were arranged in different formations that told the story that led you towards this rock. Now, this particular mound is the only mound in Australia where elders can come and do their ceremonies from all over the country and do their ceremonies off country at this particular place. It was considered sacred to all original people in the whole of the country. You see, Stonehenge was put back together through guesswork. When we put the stones back on the on the Standing Stone site, we actually had the map with the name of each rock written on it by Slater. So we actually have a map. Well, when we put that up on the computer in my image, we took it off the map. And we know the distance between each stone and what it means. So we have a lot more information to put this back together. And the elders know the song of the stone arrangements and the song of the hand signs, don't they, about?
Okay.
So they have the knowledge, and they still know this language.
Well, you just said something that was interesting, which is also part of the Stonehenge in England, is that there's an acoustic property imbued in the stone and the way they're arranged, that when you walk in there and you talk or you sing or you chant, it echoes, and there's a number of acoustic engineers that have measured the power of the repelled sound. They don't really understand what it was used for. It seems to have some imbued technology in it. Do you find that in this Australian version, that there's some acoustic properties?
Well, the problem with the Australian version, we have to remember that in 1940, the site was destroyed. The actual 184 standing stones were bulldozed. Now, that was because the government had come to the farmer's door and we're going to confiscate his land. So we don't blame the farmer for this because he'd actually been working and cooperating with Slater, and had actually closed the paddock off so that the cattle wouldn't walk on the stones. So he did come from the right place. But in 1940, during the Second World War, when the government comes to your door and they say whatever they're going to say, they can get away with it, they said they were going to destroy the site. So the son was sent out to bulldoze the actual, well, not bulldoze, but to displow the stones. But the trick with that is the stones aren't gone. You see, they're all down the bottom. There's about 150 of them laying down the bottom. So all of that stuff is damaged, but can all be put back together again.
Ah, so they're still existing. They've just been pushed
over. Oh, yeah,
the
stones are still there. They didn't take them away and kill them. They just bulldozed them into the paddock. So if we get ground-penetrating radar and we get some we get some infrared drones above, we'll be able to find all of the rocks and plus the 10 acres with all those arrangements. They were bulldozed too. We have to put them all back. Now, we do have the diagrams, but we still need to know where they were.
That's amazing.
So it's in a massive complex, and if it is what Slater said, the beginning of humanity, then there's something we need to look at because it's a language of 28,000 words. But when you see what's written there, it is so sublime and so religious. And I always thought the first language was us grunting and basically food, fire, sex, rocks, tools, and that's it. This is not the way this language comes out. It is really sublime. And what's interesting, and Slater knew this, didn't he, Evan?
Yeah.
The most commonly used word in all of his interpretations was a phrase of three words. Came to earth. Hmm. That is where Slater got into trouble. Because that's what he was reading. It was about someone coming to earth and bringing life with them.
Hmm. Wow.
So that sort of pushed things into an area. In 1939, Slater, it was okay then because everyone was talking about Egypt and Australia. We have got so many clippings, haven't we, Evan? Everybody knew that Egyptians were in Australia. It was in the front page in all the papers. But then Slater went further and started talking about the gods. And he spoke about the son of Biami, who's like the creator spirit, who was not born of the earth, and came down for a while, then went back to where she was born in the stars, and started talking like that. Hmm. Then spoke of Mula Mula, who didn't want to stay here, and climbed back into this tree that mingled with the clouds, and when it took off, there was smoke below, and it went up towards the Southern Cross. He started reporting that word for word in his interpretations, because the original people absolutely believed part of their ancestry comes from the Pleiades.
Well, let me ask you this. Yeah. So if Slater was making these claims in 39, and you're saying there was kind of a revival of some kind of knowledge about Egyptians being in Australia, what was the basis of that? Were there some new artifacts that they had found
everywhere
at that time?
Well, I can tell you this.
A specific ruin, an ancient ruin of some kind that was identified?
It was everything, mate, to be honest. It was a massive information. There's a guy called Sir Grafton Elliot Smith who said this in 1914. He was the only Australian to be knighted for services to academia, and he was actually a professor in England. Mm-hmm. He said there is so much evidence of Egyptians in Australia, he's astounded by it. It was everywhere. Honestly, there are museums all over Australia that have closets full of this stuff because it was handed in by some of the top academics in the country. Mm-hmm. Because it was open, we have so many reports of this on front page, second page, third page.
This is interesting.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. We were quite shocked, to be honest, because I actually been teaching people about, you know, I've been teaching the kids about how the original people were treated, and we started picking up all these quotes from the 1930s and 20s, and what is going on here?
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking about Egyptians being everywhere, of mummification. They found 16 different forms of mummification in Australia. I think, who was it? Sir Ralph Sorrento, didn't he, Evan?
Yeah.
He said one of the mummies they found at Darnley Island was identical to the embalming process of the 21st to 23rd dynasty. So much so they used the same bone tool to extract the actual nose, and then they rose the coffin out 2 kilometres to be judged by a crocodile spirit. Same ceremony, the whole thing. It was well known.
Wow.
But I think Slater went too far by actually saying, they're starting this talk about coming from afar and bringing a seed. Mm-hmm. I think that's where he got smashed, because from that point on, Slater lost his posting and he never had anything published, and all of his work in every university disappeared.
Well, it's funny because I haven't had a chance to look up Slater in any Wikipedia or something like that, but apparently he was an Egyptologist.
Yes.
Who, you know, and if you're an Egyptologist, you're going to recognize the artifacts from Egypt. So, and if you're saying that there was kind of a revival in the 30s of artifacts, was he riding on the crest of that information and just took it to the next level, or was he always involved in this discovery of evidence of Egyptian settlements?
Well, it was both, because he was the head of the department. Therefore, it was his job as an archaeologist, because he was the president, to speak on behalf of the people working. Look, I know the papers he wrote. He wrote those papers with quite a few other archaeologists, didn't he, Evan? There was a team each time he'd announced them.
Yeah.
He was the spokesperson for them. That was his job to do that. Mm-hmm. He took many others out there with him, and they went out there with him and said, yeah, it is right. It was just, it is absolutely. Now, yes, in Wikipedia, Slater wasn't even mentioned until quite recently. He is an inconvenience for mainstream Australia, because what he was saying was correct in every sense, and he was getting it right. But the problem was, what he was saying, they just didn't want to hear. And I'm actually finding, strangely enough, they still don't want to hear it.
Interesting. Evan, what did you discover in terms of this kind of a revival? Did you go back and were you able to find documents where they showed these artifacts of Egyptian ancestry?
Yeah, well, through one of our research contacts, Eric Bauer, he kind of pointed us in the right direction, and we've just got article after article after article, to the extent where, yeah, we didn't think there'd be anything left. But, there's just little articles in all the national papers about this. And it was like, it wasn't just like one paper. It was like he'd announce a finding, and then every single paper in Australia for every capital city would then do that article. Mm. It's like, oh, here we go again, another thing from Frederick Slater.
His stuff was always, because in those days, radio was just beginning and there was no TV, so people read the paper for information. And if he's on the first or second or third page, that means people read it. It was common knowledge, and it's undeniable, and the academics can't deny it because it's true. But the problem was that I think the Slater, you probably know yourself, after the Second World War, there was a clampdown on all sorts of information all over the shop, right? This is part of that same story. Hmm. I mean, we struggled to find his bloody burial site, didn't we, Evan? It's an unmarked tomb. We couldn't find it. We haven't found one picture of the man. No picture, but it survived. We actually did one article where it put up a picture of Evan and said that's what he could have looked like.
Are you talking about Slater? There's no pictures of Slater anywhere?
Nowhere. No, look, he was actually smashed everywhere because he went too far. This is why we kept chasing this, because the more we found there was nothing about him, the more we thought, well, why would you go to that much trouble? Why would you take every paper? There is only one paper that survives, is Slater. And it was because it was written by Goddard and Slater, and Goddard's name went first.
Mind you, on the front of it, it's got a stamp.
Cancelled, that's right.
By the Department of Tropical Medicine and
Health
or something.
Of Sydney Uni, cancelled his paper. So there was a paper we found, but it was cancelled by Sydney Uni. So when he writes in his letters that Sydney Uni don't trust them, well, when the Department of Tropical Health can cancel your paper, you really are doing it tough.
Keeping in mind, I'm reading an article about that paper when he presented it to the Science Congress and loved the paper so much.
Yeah, they clapped. They all clapped and applauded when he presented this paper. It was a well-received, and we've actually got newspaper clippings saying it was well-received. So, yes, ladies and gentlemen, in Australia in the 1930s, the idea that Egyptians were here was very important. But remember one thing, Slater made this very clear. He said the Egyptians learned their hieroglyphs and their language from the original people. This is where the story starts to change, you see, because everyone thinks, oh, the Egyptians, the great makers of the pyramids, they must have come as the masters. No, they came as the apprentices. Hmm. Because we know when you spoke about Mu and these people were looking for the meaning of life, the Egyptians were into that, but guess where they got their inspiration from? They came here for that.
You know, it's fascinating to think about this discovery and this information about the artifacts of Egyptian settlements, because I, here in the States, I've heard about it and I read a little bit about it, but it seems like, you know, somebody's fanciful idea. If there are artifacts, it seems like they've been hidden away because they don't want to bring them out and reveal that there is a possible link. But this discovery of, what do they call it, the Karyon glyphs?
Yes, I've been there. Probably how many times we've been there between us, Evan? 40 times?
Yeah, something like that.
Where is that located? Where are those glyphs?
They're located near a place called Gosford, about 100 kilometres from Sydney. Mm-hmm. And what they are, a series of about 300 glyphs. Now, the trick is that there's one panel that we strongly believe is Proto-Egyptian and talks about the two sons of the pharaoh coming here, but we believe the rest of the panels are older and of a more ancient language. And when experts looked at it, they said exactly the same. I don't blame them. They said, oh, it's a fake because that panel is Egyptian, but the rest is a pastiche of all types of glyphs. Well, yeah, it is there. We believe there's both the original language written in there and also the Egyptian language. Now, what people don't know is we've discovered another panel of glyphs, because the whole story about the Carrion glyphs being fake is based on those walls, that someone went to those walls. There's no rule about them going all over the countryside making glyphs everywhere. But we've found other sets of glyphs, and they're exactly the same types of glyphs as those.
Okay.
And it is a legitimate story because the elders told us what took place with those glyphs. There was originally a roof on the top, a rock roof, which a bulldozer drove over the top and was pushing in rubbish in the bush and broke it.
Yeah.
But Arnie Bev, who was the last full descent Darking Knoll elder, and that's the area we're talking about, told us the original women would go up there every second and third year and coat the glyphs in women's urine to keep it fresh. So it is definitely been there for a long time, and it belongs to the original people, and it is part of the story of the Egyptians being here. That marks the time they came to Australia, which was 4,600 years ago. And they stayed in Australia. There was a presence of original Egyptians in Australia until 400 years ago. Mm-hmm. Continuous.
You know, it's interesting, though. If you look at the Carrion glyphs, they're not... I mean, when I think of a glyph, Egyptian glyphs, when you go to Cairo or the Giza Plateau and you see the stonework, they're extremely precision cut. They're all very formed well, and they're in lines and things like that. You know, they're on stoneworks that they carved into. And
yeah.
And the Carrion seems to be almost like a, for better lack of a better word, it's kind of like a somebody cutting into a stone, like I was, Bill was here, you know, or or something like that. They're like they came in and they left an impression. And then it wasn't like they were staying anywhere. Have there been any other kind of solid stone hieroglyphs that have been found other than this one area?
Yeah, there are others. Honestly, there are some up in up the top end. There are quite a few throughout the country. We know of about three or four. There are different markers from different stories. That one marked out, and as you said, it was very much, if you look at it very carefully, there's not the same precision as you're expecting you'd see as you're talking about in Egypt. This was done to a different story, to a different group of people.
Okay.
This was done by the original people. We believe, and when you look very carefully, you will find that the section that was done by the Egyptians is not as deep. It's quite thin, isn't it?
Yep.
And a finer cut. And it is a bit more delicate. And everyone has said, oh, there's more than one stage, there's more than one pen, there are more than one scribe, and there certainly is. And you'll find the part you're talking about is a bit more, it's much larger, and it's not quite as precise and as delicate. So there is a difference because it was not Egyptian, but there is Egyptian stuff there as well.
Yeah, there's a lot of rock engravings of kind of godlike figures that are half animal, half human as well, with ibis heads. And
oh, yes, yeah. We've got ibis head people. We've got Thoth in profile form. We've got engravings of Duramulin, the son of Bayami, but he's wearing an Egyptian headdress. We've got an Ankh on one of the most sacred sites around there that was done by original people. We have, as I said, this is why these guys were saying this. They're saying it because they're looking at the same stuff we're seeing. We're saying, what's an Ankh doing here that's 10,000 years old? And it's a damn good question. And you'll find next to the Ankh, there's an ibis footprint that's been put right alongside it, hasn't it?
Yep.
Now, who would have an ibis footprint that carries an Ankh? And then you get back that story of Thoth. And yes, we've got another engraving where Thoth, well, it is Thoth, has got the moon in one hand and the sun in the other. And their hands are outstretched. So that Egyptian mythology, we have the Egyptian god of inheritance there, don't we? Yes. Exactly, with your hands raised. There is so many of those carvings there. It gets back to what Slater said, which came first, the Egyptians or Australians? And the answer is they got their inspiration from here.
Is there any way that anyone has done any time validation in terms of, I mean, you can't really carbon date stone to know how old that work is, but has anyone given it a shot to see or guessed at how old those glyphs are?
It's very difficult because of the fact that people have been running their fingers over it anyway, which taints the site, as you know.
Right, yeah.
And all you can do things like thermoluminescence. Yeah, there are things that could be done. They're quite expensive. And, of course, we're doing this basically on the smell of an oily rag. We can't afford that. But it can be done.
Yeah.
And, in fact, the elders have told us many, many times, those idiots who say that was done by chisel, said get them to take a chisel there, and when they hit that rock there, it will crumble.
Yeah.
It will crumble. And you know what? When you look at the circles there, you can't, you know, a circle, if it's done by a chisel, you'll see a little bit of a straightness where it joins up again. Mm-hmm. These are perfectly round. Every time they did a circle, it's like someone just cut straight into it, into the sandstone. And we've actually got a lot of rocks, hundreds of rocks, where they've cut into molten rocks. So there's a lot of things going on in this country that don't make sense.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, that would need money.
Yeah, I hear you. What is, does Slater discuss anything about ruins, cities, or the foundations, or is there any evidence of any buildings that may have been attributed to Egyptians?
Yeah, look, it's hard to say now because I believe we've got evidence of an older civilization, like the, before that 12,000-year period where something major took place on this planet.
Mm-hmm.
And then we've got the civilizations that have come since then. Are there other buildings and remains? Yes, there's some up in the Kimberleys. Those rock things up there, remember? Those rock walls up there that are quite interesting. We haven't been up to them yet, but around the area we've got at the moment, Klaus's walls, that one is definitely, because we do know. Klaus Dune has been working on this, and we've got to be careful how far we go with this one, but we do know this one has traps around it. There's a gallery at the end of these three walls, and inside there's something inside there, which is very Egyptian, but where, as I said, we actually stumbled upon, there's a proper trap, isn't there, Evan?
Yeah.
And that made us walk away a bit. We've walked away from that one. So, look, there's a lot of stuff that's in, a lot of stuff we're looking at where there are remains of things that have taken place, but the pyramids? Yeah, well, if you go back to the standing stone site, yeah, there are pyramids there, but that's another story, and we're still working on that one. So, yes, there is more stuff, and some of that we're working on, and other stuff is pretty difficult at the moment.
What would you, I mean, have there been any other Egyptologists that have a look at this carry-on glyphs, anybody with any kind of understanding of hieroglyphs to look it over?
Yeah. Well,
first of all, the first person that went in there and kind of translated was Raymond Johnson.
And he worked with the, didn't he work with the Egyptian
It was the director of the Cairo Library.
Yeah, Dr. Abu Diaghazi. And he wrote the manual to interpret this and wrote it with her. And we've actually got handwritten notes from her saying he's on track.
How? What year was that? What year did he...
That was the first one, like the 1990?
Yeah, the early 90s.
Early 90s. Now, he worked with...
Well, that's pretty recent then. It's recent.
It is recent. And his work, and it, we've actually got handwritten responses from her saying, we are happy with what you're doing, you're on track, keep doing it. They were backing this for quite some time. And then you've got the Kemet School that came in, and one of those guys is an Egyptologist, but he read it slightly differently because he tried to read all of the walls, and I don't think he can. I think you can read the first wall. Ray Johnson's got a lovely interpretation of the first wall.
Yep.
Then what we found was when you go to the second and third wall, the match-up to Proto-Egyptian is around 42%. Not 85% to 90% like on the first wall. And that's what makes me think that, no, we've got something much older
and
again.
And then Laird Scranton found some some symbols in there. That
a lot of Dogon symbols in there that he recognised straight away, and as Dogon. So CR, we're talking about this pistache on the second and third wall, of all these different symbols. But then the Dagon takes some from, the Egyptians take some from, the Sumerians take some from.
Yeah, funny enough, that area is actually called Bambara, and the neighbouring tribe to the Dagon are called the Bambara. I mean, it's...
Mm-hmm. It's a coincidence, perhaps, but if you look up Wikipedia, there's only two entries for that, the neighbouring tribe to the Dagon and the road that leads to the Carrion Cliffs. So there's a lot of little sort of leads that run off in directions there. And Laird, and he found, well, we found about 40 glyphs there that certainly look very Dagon, don't they?
Yeah. And it was a very astrophysics-based, philosophical...
Very esoteric reading from his point of view. He was talking about magnetism and all sorts of lifting dimensions and all sorts of stuff.
The reason I bring up... corroborating evidence from another Egyptologist. When this happens around the world now, a good example would be the Bosnian pyramids.
Yeah.
When they were discovered, and Dr. Sam Osmanovic said he believed they were based on some of the artifacts he found. In the beginning, people like Zahi Hawass and his group came and said, no, this is not a pyramid, you're crazy, so on and so forth. And there were other experts that said that. And then there were true Egyptologists and even a couple people that were pyramid experts that came out and said, this has all the markings of a natural man-made pyramid that was formed by a pyramid. So the validation came in that form. And when I mention it, I ask you about validating evidence from either an Egyptologist or, you know, somebody who has studied hieroglyphs, maybe they could look at that and go, well, you know, this looks like this time period or that time period or first dynasty, second, you know what I mean?
We've got two different people giving us two different dynasties, haven't we, Evan?
Yeah.
It's really interesting like that. And I think the confusion is that they're trying to accommodate. And what they've been saying is things like, oh, the scribe might not have been a fully qualified scribe and made mistakes. So therefore, they're making accommodations for markings there. And I think that is the problem. I think if they looked at the first wall, they would say, yes, I've got Egypt there. I agree with you. But the problem we've got is as simple as this. And you made this comment at the start, that nobody in the rest of the world's taken any interest in Australia until quite recently when we started sort of making a bit of noise. So no one's looked here. No one's come here. Yeah. And they just assumed that nothing is here. As like when Graham Hancock spent 6 days with us, at the end of it, he said, how can you have so much stuff? And I said, it's simple. Because there's no one else in the country who's looking and no one else in the world who is. So we've got an open market here. Every day we get someone contacting us to go to a place or give us something else. We have rocks that come to us through the post constantly because there's nowhere else to go. So you're right. We would love for an Egyptologist that was open-minded and didn't come with a preset agenda and came along and looked at it and said, yeah, I can see this is Egyptian, but I don't think that is. And we'd say, yeah, you got that right.
Well, you know, Stephen, I think it's one of those things where you got to write a book and have pictures of it, or you got to have a link to your website that has, you know, evidence, and you say, okay, what do you think kind of deal, you know what I mean? Because otherwise it's like no one. You seem like the only group, you and Evan are the only ones that are really posting this information. Your website's fabulous. It's just filled with stuff. Let's talk a little bit about, and you just mentioned this, you talked about these rocks, artifacts. You have a portion in your website called Anomalous Artifacts that not only you have discovered, but maybe people are sending them to you. Can you tell us a little bit about these artifacts? Why are they defined as anomalous, and why are they so interesting to you?
Well, I'll give you one example. It's the rock we called Rosa's Rock 1. Now, this particular rock was actually dug out in the 1990s, 1 meter beneath the surface on the top of the sandstone hill, 1 kilometer from the Carrion Glyphs, which was fascinating in itself. Now, this lady held this rock and took to experts. They all said, we don't know what it is. And finally, it got into our hands. Now, I do know the Smithsonian looked at this rock twice and written back and said, there's nothing like it in the world. And they are right about this. The problem with this rock is because it was found so deep beneath the surface on the top of a hill, it takes a long time for 1 meter of sandstone to accumulate above the rock. Secondly, that rock is not part of the area. Everything there is sandstone, and this rock is either a meteorite or something different again. Now, what's unusual about the rock, and we've had one of the top geologists in the country, a professor, that looked at this rock for an hour, and he had it in his hand, he wouldn't let go, had to pull it out of his hand. He said it's the greatest mystery on the planet. Now, the reason he said that is because the rock is so hard. If you bought a chisel today, and I've dropped this rock accidentally on concrete, haven't I? And about three times.
Yeah, I almost had a stroke.
I cannot believe I've done it, because he told me you could drop it on concrete, you wouldn't leave a mark. And I said to him, no, mate, I've never did that. I've done it three times. You could throw it on concrete and you won't leave a mark, but something has cut lines deep into the chert. Now, what we found with this chert has been melted on top of a base rock. Now, to melt chert, you need 1,703 degrees Celsius. And then they've cut it. It's not been chiseled, but cut like a potter would have cut. And they've made lines, straight lines. They're maps. Now, the problem is the technology involved in that. Then it goes further. We also know they put infills in where they put holes in there and stuck something in there that stayed there for 10,000 years. And when you look at these rocks, you see a mass of technology that we would have trouble doing today.
And we've got Dr. Derek Cunningham.
The angles
of each line.
And, you know, you were talking about the Bosnian Pyramid, right? Dr. Samir sent us a rock that had 15 angles, and they knew about our work. And they said, look at these angles. Can you get them measured? And we did. And those 15 angles, we then compared them to Ross's Rock 1, and all of the 15 angles that Dr. Samir had on the Bosnian rock, we had also. And then we looked at the Calgary rock that Dr. Derek Cunningham brought in, and it's got 21 angles on it. 19 of those angles are on Ross's Rock 1. So what we're finding in Bosnia, in Calgary, and in Australia is the angles, 13.66. These are very defined angles, ladies and gentlemen, are on all three rocks. What are the chances of a coincidence like that? And there we're starting to learn this story. So this particular rock we're talking about, not only is the technology amazing, but it's a language, because the angles are repeated in Bosnia and Calgary, and they are the same angles. So this rock redefines. Now, what sort of language is this, where it's done through mathematical angles? I'm going to tell you now, it's far more intelligent a language than anything we have today. And I don't believe any of us will ever decode it, because it's beyond our intellect. I believe the people who made this language are far more intelligent than the rabble that's walking the streets today. So what we're looking at here, if it's going around the world, it backs up our story of an international language. But that rock was cut and shaped and melted with technology that we just have in some cases today. And in one rock, it was melted twice, wasn't it, Evan? And on the second time it was melted, the rock was melted and it dribbled down the side of the face of one rock like a candle would when it runs down the side again. And you could see dribble marks where it was actually heated.
Have you compared these stone artifacts to what's been discovered by Michael Tellinger in South Africa, his stones, and also Dr. Danny Hillman, the unusual stones that have been discovered at Gunung Penang in Java?
Michael Tellinger was with us when we saw the rock the very first time. The lady who presented it to us presented it to both of us. And during the day, Michael was saying, my God, this looks like the Bombos rocks, but much better.
Oh, really?
Yes, Mike saw the rock. We were working on it together. Michael, we've actually done talks there. He's been there a couple of times with us. He knows. He was there the very first time we saw it, and he couldn't believe it. He said, this is changing everything. He said, the Bombos rocks, rubbish compared to this. This is a work of art, the work on this particular rock. So, yeah, no, we have.
Yeah.
And they are blown away by it too.
We also have Cylons, which are...
Cylons. The ones that ring like a bell. We've got those ones too.
Wow.
So, yes, Michael and I, we've been working a lot, because Michael loves his Cylons, and, yes, we've just started collecting them too. I said at one stage, no, I'm not collecting the yours, Michael, but they've been forced onto us. And now that an elder told us the story of the Cylons, we actually did take them.
So is there any magnetic properties? I mean, the stones that Michael found in South Africa, They have an acoustic property. They seem like they're artificial, and they also, I can't remember, I think he said they also have some magnetic properties too.
Yeah, look, the rocks have only been in for a couple of months. We did some amazing experiments with them, which I've written about already.
Okay.
I think I put them up on the website, yeah. We did an amazing experiment at the Gosford Lift site, actually. And now some gentlemen have bought some machinery, because a guy ran some machinery over these rocks, some different apps, because I'm a computer novice, I know nothing about it, and the needles went crazy. And I know that white fellas like machines that go bit with needles, so this guy bought about four of these needles. We're going to put them on. We go down to Sydney in a couple of weeks because we're working with a mob called, is it Ancient Aliens?
Yeah.
The film crew. We're going down to Sydney in a couple of weeks to work with them on the carry-on site, and we're going to get the machines out and see what they do.
Wow.
So that's a work in motion, Cliff. We're about to do it. And we got a guy that bought all those machines that make the bit noise and have the needles to go up and down.
Yeah, the magnometers, and they have resonance.
Yeah, they said those words to me, but I just pull someone in who knows what they're doing. And I just know that white fellas like machines. It's a bit like the Monty Python skit in the brain surgery thing where you get lots of machines that make noises they love. So we're going to do that for you.
We're going to test them out. Did you say the crew out from the United States, the Ancient Alien crew, is coming to visit you guys?
Yeah, they've been working on this for quite some time. Yeah, we're in the final stages now. We're actually lining up the elders they're going to talk to. They're going to ring them next week.
Wow.
And should be down within about, I don't know yet. We're getting the final date. They also have worked out there's something going on in Australia. Mm-hmm. They're going to start with one show. And I think one of the places they're doing, we mentioned Carry On, because the people who are listening, they'll get to see it.
Yeah, definitely. We do have people that are very big on the Ancient Aliens. In the last few minutes we have, I want to talk with you regarding your work with the Aborigine tribes and their importance. I've never met a member of any of the tribes, but I've read a couple of books by people who have gone down there intuitively and met with them. One gentleman had such an amazing experience that he actually was transformed into this incredible healer. Other people have gone down there, and there is an underlying intelligence of certain tribal members. There seems to be highly developed senses of telepathy and other what we would call psychic abilities. Can you tell us a little bit about what your experience is? I know obviously they're telling you about the history of the world according to their perception, but what do you think is the most important aspect of those people in those tribes?
Well, that's a great question. And the best way to give this is to give an exact example, because Evan and I both looked at each other and sort of went, you know what I'm going to talk about.
I know exactly what you want
to
talk about.
But the best way to give an example of what we're missing out on is some people think that the old ways, those sort of mystical ways, are gone. Okay, they think it's history. It's not. So I want to give an example, and the person who can back you up on this is Graham Hancock, because Graham shared this with us. Okay? We're all working with our elder, a very important elder that gave me ceremony. Kano, and I can't give his last name because he's passed on, and by original law I cannot mention his full name. Now, he's from the old way, and he'll put it to you from this one. He comes from both sides. Now, I'll give you an example of what these people still can do. He's not the last one, but he's one of the last few, and it's still being passed on. Graham Hancock was allowed to come on site in Australia, and he spent 6 days with us under the condition on the last day he had to spend time with the elders, or it wasn't going to happen. Him and Sanford agreed to that. So on the last day, we were sitting out time at night on sacred country, open fire, and Kano appeared from nowhere, dressed up old way, all the white ochre across his body, just a lap on top, all painted up in sacred design. Then he started singing songs and doing some traditional stuff. Then he did the whispering song, which is very hard to describe, but it's an amazing piece of work. And then in the finish of the story, he stepped back one step, and there's a big fire there, and we're surrounded by blue metal gravel, and we're all watching him. Then he stepped back the second step, and he completely disappeared. And I still remember, and Evan still remembers the look on Graham Hancock's face. His mouth was so far open, Evan, he could have caught 1,000 flies, couldn't he?
Yep.
The best part was within a second later, their Kano reappeared about 30 metres away behind his wife, Christine, and all around us was blue metal gravel. So when you walk on it, you can hear the
crunch,
footsteps.
Crunch.
Crunching all the way through with this huge smile on his face. And all of us are just looking there because no one's sitting here for a long period of time. And later on, I went up to Christine and I said to Christine, I've seen Kano do a lot of things. I said, come on, Christine, what's going on this time? And her answer was, I don't know. I've never seen that either. That is what they have. Now, we have flat screen TVs, and I know we have flash cars, and we have all sorts of wonderful technology, right? And a lot of people think it's pretty deadly. But you know what? I think that's even more deadly. Now, they're the sort of people like Kano, when he looked at you, you can ask anyone. Most of us didn't want to look at him. Why?
It's like he was peering straight into your soul.
Comes out the other side. And you knew it. You know that story about, oh, this guy can see straight through me.
Yeah.
There was a person that you really understood what that meant, where you just knew that if you said anything that wasn't wrong,
it wasn't right, yeah.
So that is what we're missing out on, ladies and gentlemen. Yeah, we've got all the flash things as today, but we've given up something in return. Now, these are the people who could levitate. I used to sit here and hear stories. I heard a story once when Kano told me how Bluey knocked over his totem, which was a kangaroo on the road there. And he stood there in a state of shock because you can't hurt your totem. And he's offering sort of solace. And then he reappeared about 150 k's away in front of about 15 people. They were all talking about in front of me and just talking about the day. Not trying to prove anything to me, just discussing what happened. And every one of them thought that was normal.
Wow.
So that is what that story is about in a practical form. Ring Graham Hancock.
do you think that by living on the land like they have and living in a certain way for, who knows, thousands and thousands of years, that they have some knowledge that we just don't possess? That gives them certain unusual abilities, and I mean, they don't live in areas that I in America would consider comfortable. They live in hot, very terrible parts of Australia that are just god awful. But because they have such good control, maybe over their bodies or their ability to adapt, that it isn't considered bad by them. But I mean. They seem like very, very unusual humans.
Yeah, well, I think you've got it right because they're so attached to country. I mean, I do know Ancient Aliens wanted to put on a ceremony, and I told them we can't do one because we'd have to go away from Sydney and gossip because they can't do a ceremony, a proper one, unless they're on their country. Everything relates to their country. When they walk on their country, every step they put on there is very carefully placed. They look where they're going all the time. Mm-hmm. So you are right. They have spent hundreds upon hundreds of thousands of years, ever since they gave up the technology that they used to use, basically wearing no clothes, asking the spirits for guidance, and making sure that everything they did was in accord with nature's plan. They've been doing this for so long that they've become part of nature's plan. So therefore, for them to talk to a bird is normal. All right, like the wagtail has come to us quite a few times, and when they come, I bring up Kano and say, a wagtail did this, what does that mean? And then he told me the full story. On one occasion, Evan and I went on the country and we didn't smoke ourselves. Now, Kano lives 3,000 k's away. He rang me that night from South Australia, and I'm living in Byron Bay, and he rang up and said, you've been on country today. I said, yeah, but I didn't tell you that. He said, you didn't smoke yourself. I said, how do you know that? He said, I have a red kangaroo standing right next to me telling me everything. Now, he knew that I hadn't smoked myself. I didn't tell him. Evan, did you tell him?
No, I didn't tell him.
We got the phone call that night, and he told me the kangaroo told him. And I said, how did that happen? He said, well, the owl flew out as we went in there, which it did.
Yeah, it did.
The owl went and told another animal, which told another animal. Before we knew it, 3,000 k's away, and Kangaroo Island, by the way, is off the Australian mainland. It's an island. He knew that night. We'd been on country and hadn't smoked ourselves because the animals speak to them too. That's
wow.
Sort of story. That's what we shouldn't be trying to throw that away, ladies and gentlemen. If we've got people like that, We should be saying, maybe I don't want that flat screen TV anymore. Maybe I wouldn't mind talking to the animals a bit, eh? They might have some wisdom we don't have. And the answer to that is they've got a lot of wisdom.
Fascinating. Well, you know, you guys have given me and the audience a real amazing insight into ancient Australia. And just for our audience members, you can go to Stephen and Evan's, Evan Strong's website, which is actually very well done. It's called ForgottenOrigins.com or Origin.
Origin, dot, yep.
Single, yeah, not, yeah. ORIGIN.com. And it's filled with all their discoveries. There's a section on anomalous artifacts. There's a section on Stonehenge. There's a section on Egypt discoveries and history of astronomy in Australia. And it's fascinating. You guys have done a great job.
Yeah.
In the last couple of minutes we have, what would you like our audience to take away from your understanding of ancient Australia? Why is it unique, and why do you feel that people need to know about it?
Now, I'll do this in a less scientific way. I'll talk about this year. The reason, some people ask us, why do we get all these sacred sites? And I've told them the same story all the way along. The elders are very, very, very keen the information gets out this year. They have a great belief that this is a defining year. And they have a belief, and this is one of the reasons we're doing this, that their culture will come again and their ways will rule again. They had a prophecy that the white fella would come to Australia for 10 generations. And on the 11th generation, they would take the land back. Now, I'll go one step further than that. I've seen the sticks. There are sacred sticks they place in the ground. I know they place one in the ground once. There's a day in the future where the sacred sticks will all be placed in the ground, not just in Australia, but in other places too. My take is it's going to be this year. So it is important we start to learn about the old ways, because the old ways, ladies and gentlemen, in the near future might become the new ways again.
Yeah, because we operate under a banner that
yeah.
Created called Wirigin, which is blackfella, whitefella dream, which is the future.
The future is all of us are going to work as one. The original people have been saying this. They're not bitter. They're not bitter because they always knew their country would come back to them and their culture would come back. And they believe that when it comes back to them, because they're the ones who began the whole story, it comes back to everybody.
Fascinating. Stephen and Evan Strong, thank you very much. I definitely want to get back in touch with you guys. And if I'm ever out there, I will definitely look you guys up.
Goodbye.
Awesome.
Continue success. I hope that the word gets out and that you can collect the funds to resurrect the Stonehenge out there. That sounds like a fascinating place. And maybe you're going to, what they call, do a forced birth of a resurrection of ancient knowledge that's been perhaps hidden and stored away in Australia, and kind of like, you know, create a movement of people who can kind of liberate the minds of the ones in power so that they can begin opening the gates and letting some of this knowledge out a little bit.
The portals are open. Don't worry about that. They're coming.
All right. Good talking with you.
Thanks, man.
Thank
I really
you.
Appreciate it. Good work. I appreciate what you said. Thank you.
Okay. So that was Uncovering Ancient Australia. That was recorded last night. What was it? 6 o'clock. Actually, excuse me. It was almost 7 o'clock San Francisco Pacific Coast time, which was... let's see, that was about 2 o'clock Byron Bay, Australia time. So it worked out great. We had a lot of problems with the sound at that point and the connection. Skype was not working. They're in a part of Australia that doesn't seem to have really strong internet service. So we were lucky because leading up to the call, we had not been able to connect. So perfect timing, everything worked out. I hope you like that. You really got to check out their website too. It's fascinating what they have on there. Not only do they have a ton of great photographs. They're constantly updating it. ForgottenOrigin.com, ForgottenOrigin.com contains probably the best collection of unknown archaeology, anomalous discoveries and artifacts, and this Stonehenge recreated in probably the way it was laid out originally. So I'm looking forward to hearing more about that. And again, I wanted to talk with him because I had heard a lot about this Egyptian discovery, and these hieroglyphs have been posted, but they're not well known because I guess it's just too sensitive for the government to consider. So check it out. All right. So I do want to make the announcement for the winner of the Graham Hancock new bestseller, Magicians of the Gods. I opened my envelope here, and the envelope had the number 370, which is what I wrote down. The closest number that came to that, let's see, 370, was 376, and that was turned in by Laura Davis of Cedar Rapids, Iowa. So, Laura Davis, congratulations. You will be receiving the book, Magicians of the God by Graham Hancock, brand new copy. We'll send it out. I'm going to go ahead and post that on the website, the Earth Ancients website on Facebook. And congratulations. You should get that in a couple weeks, if not sooner. And that's one of two books. We'll do this again. I'll make the announcement. I think I'm going to wait a week to do the next announcement. So we'll probably do it mid-February. We'll send out and have a raffle for the second book. So you'll have an opportunity, those of you who missed out, to get a copy of the book. I'm really happy to announce this next guest for next week, February 6th. We've talked a lot about the ruins of Egypt, the Giza Plateau, the Great Pyramid, the Sphinx, and the amazing evidence of machinery. The foremost authority to date, based on our current technology, our current evolution, is a guy named Christopher Dunn. I've known Chris for about 20 years. I had him on in a show of mine. What was it called? New Science, Ancient Wisdom was a conference I had 20 years ago. And he was nice enough to come out and be one of our speakers. And he wrote a book at that time called The Giza Pyramid Power Plant. And since then, he's been back many times. And for those of you who don't know Chris Dunn is a manufacturing engineer with 50 years of experience. He worked primarily in the aerospace industry and developed precision laser applications for measuring and for creating tools and parts, I guess, for rocket engines and things like that. He's just a brilliant guy. But he wrote a book in 2000 called Lost Technologies of Ancient Egypt, Advanced Engineering in the Temples of the Pharaohs. And what's fascinating about this book and why people like Graham Hancock, Robert Schock, Robert Bavall, and anybody having to do with ancient Egypt is because Christopher Dunn analyzes these sculptures, analyzes the cuts in the stone, analyzes the stone works, and has revealed 20 years ago that he believed that they were cut with technology. And what does that mean? Powered tools, powered devices, saws, sanders, and in some cases, precision-guided technology, cutting away stone to create sculptures, to create stone blocks, and probably created the pyramid. And in this fascinating book, Lost Technologies of Ancient Egypt, he shows evidence of the Ramses to monstrous sculptures. these huge, huge, huge sculptures, beautiful, beautiful sculptures that were cut. Now, the reason that we're going to bring him on is that I think it's time that we talk in depth about amazing, monstrous, multi-ton sculptures. And we're going to really dive in and discuss what he believes are possible machines that cut the stone. So stay tuned. That's next Friday. We're going to do it live. If you want to call in and ask questions of Chris, of what you you would like to know, this is the time to do it. And I'm really, really happy he's agreed to do this. He only gives limited numbers of interviews, and this guy is the foremost authority. And, you know, for those, the other thing is, Egyptologists cannot say, oh, you know, this was cut by copper chisels and stone on stone, because Chris shows them, look, people, you're full of it. This is not stone on stone. This is not chisels. This is technology that we, in some cases, cannot reproduce today. This is a lost art. This is a civilization that had extremely advanced cutting tools, sanders. I mean, they were able to cut in stone that may have used lasers for all we know. We just don't know. But Chris will tell us all the details. So stay tuned for that next show. This is an exclusive program with Chris Dunn, and we're going to post it, the details on the Facebook page. We're going to have Chris. I spoke to him yesterday. He's looking forward to this. This is next Saturday on the program. So look forward to having you with us. And be sure to check in on the Facebook page. We're going to be posting photos from today's show. We continue to post groundbreaking and up-to-the-minute information on ancient Earth. And you can, see it all right there. So I hope you'll join us next week. And continually be looking at the Facebook page. All right. Have a great day.